The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your usual host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. We're coming to you from Edstone, England, though not live, as everyone here is off on today, on Friday, celebrating the last day of unleavened bread. So I'm recording this a little ahead of time, and this means that this time I have the safety blanket of knowing that if I say anything terribly wrong, I can go back and fix it. It also means that our producer, Sam Livingston, can edit and make it sound like I'm saying things that I'm not. So if there is anything anywhere in this program today that you disagree with, it's Sam's fault. Don't forget that. Now, there have been some really outstanding articles published this week. Over at Trumpet Hour later today, we're going to focus on some of the big news stories of today. But right now, I want to focus on some of the top pieces of commentary. And there have been some really good ones and some that I'm really excited to share with you. Now, last time I was on the show, we spoke about the US military and the mind-boggling wastage that it produces. Now, there have been a few good pieces published about on the US military recently. And one of the best is by Lamont Colucci at the US News and World Report. And it's called The New Arms Race. It has the subtitle, Russia and China are developing new weapons and America sits idle at its peril. It's one of the best articles that I've seen for quite a long time on this subject. And it begins by writing, great power conflict is now acceptable to discuss. Since 9/11, those of us who warned that an overabundance of attention paid to counterterrorism would result in enhancing the myth that great power conflict is over, have been proved right. Great power conflict is not back because it never left. All the time and energy spent on how to defeat Al-Qaeda and like-minded groups have always been a sideshow to the threats that could be posed by resurgent Russia and rising China. And he's absolutely right. A few people, are now once again talking about great power conflict. All the effort that was paid to counter terrorism, to coin counterinsurgency that became the big buzzword in the US military, dramatically took the focus off America being prepared to face some of its biggest threats. And like you said, more in the media, more in the kind of international relations academia, they're waking up to this. They're waking up to the fact that, you know, there is the real possibility of great power conflict. And all along, this has been one of the big criticisms we've been making on this show of the US military. So much of the planning, the weapons acquisitions, the designs, they all act as if the biggest threat America faces is the Islamic State. And at best, America is concerned about combating an Iran-type power, but there's little thought in combating a nation like Russia or China. And there's far too little serious attention given to what kind of weapon systems the United States would need to fight a major power. And Colucci writes that in the shadow of all the provocations to America that's been made over the last few months, you know, things that we've been talking about on this program, the buzzing of the U.S. ship from Russia, all of the tension over Ukraine, the tension over the South China Sea. He writes that, in the shadow of all of this is the looming threat of new weapons that seek to undermine American military strength and defense. So in the shadow of all of these things that we've talked about is the looming threat of new weapons that seek to undermine America's military strength and defenses. And then he goes on to describe these new weapons. And I originally had intended to spend maybe 2 or 3 minutes talking about this, but he makes such good points and such points that are worth going into in depth that we will spend quite a bit longer on that. The most dangerous that he talks about is the hypersonic missile. And you may not have heard too much about this. It's a gigantic threat to America that there's very little known about it. These hypersonic missiles travel between 10 and 20 times the speed of sound, and that's hugely fast. That could make the trip from where I am right now in Edstone, just north of Stratford-upon-Avon, it could make that trip all the way over to Edmond, Oklahoma, in around half an hour. You know, those of you that have made that flight know that usually it takes, you know, at least the longest leg of the journey is around 8 hours, and there's all these other smaller flights that you have to do. You can do that in very roughly half an hour. Tremendously fast. Both Russia and China, they're working on their own different systems to do this. And China has one version, for example, it's often called the carrier killer, and they aim to have a conventional hypersonic missile that can sink U.S. aircraft carriers in the Pacific with ease. In fact, the day after this article that we're focusing on, that was published in the U.S. News and World Report, news began emerging that China had successfully tested another one of these missiles. It was their seventh test, I believe, of a hypersonic glide vehicle. The U.S. tracked it with satellites, and this missile could hit just about anywhere in the world within an hour. That's an amazing capability. Any location in the world obliterated in an hour. Compare that to how slow something like that would be with conventional bombers, even supersonic bombers that can fly faster than the speed of sound. These missiles can fly 10 to 20 times faster than the speed of sound. And this incredible speed makes them very, very hard to stop. The US simply doesn't have anything at all that can intercept these missiles. It goes so fast that often missile defenses can't see them. And even if they can, they can't react fast enough to shoot them down. The Washington Free Beacon, they wrote this week that Russian Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin told the newspaper Kommersant in October 2012 that the nation that masters hypersonic weapons first would revolutionize warfare. He compared the strategic significance of the high-speed weapons to development of the first atomic bombs. By contrast, the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency is doing little to deal with the emerging hypersonic missile threat. So they're creating these missiles, and America can't stop them at the moment, and America isn't doing much to prepare to stop them. It talks about how the Missile Defense Agency, they have a $7.5 billion budget for the fiscal year of 2017. They're not funding any direct programs to counteract hypersonic weapons. And then they are looking eventually at producing a laser, and some type of laser defense system that could target these. But the first test of the laser isn't planned until 2021. And China plans to get its first hypersonic missiles that are, you know, kind of the ones that it has been firing at the moment. They've been more experimental. But China wants to get it fully fledged, going and up and running before 2021. So they'll have these missiles, and America isn't even going to begin to experiment with stopping them until after China has them operational. Now, America, they're working on a hypersonic missile too. They're having trouble with this. There have been some failed tests. It is a tough technology to get right. I mean, there are reasons why China, they're practicing, they're doing test runs, they've done seven tests. But China genuinely seems like they're ahead of America in this regard. Such a vital high-tech weapon, and America's not in the lead. And that says something pretty dangerous about America's military. And even if America can get one of these and get these weapons working on around the same timescale as China, being able to build one of these weapons is very different to being able to shoot one down. And this could allow China to sink America's aircraft carriers with impunity. There'd be nothing America could do to defend them. They could also be used, these missiles can be used to deliver nuclear bombs in a way that cannot be intercepted. And disarmament experts, they've worried about this aspect of these weapons for a long time because, you know, say Russia launched or China launched one of these missiles, America wouldn't know for sure whether it was nuclear or not until it exploded. And so there's a worry that the development of these missiles would make an accidental nuclear war more likely. That's a bit of a different subject, but these hypersonic glide vehicles are a huge weakness for the United States, and where the United States is quite far behind. And then going back to this Colucci article, this talks about how other ways that Russian and China weapons are undermining the U.S. And the second area he brings out is a new generation of drones. He writes, the Russians are pursuing unmanned submarine drones that could carry a nuclear payload that would, in theory, allow them to sneak in or near an American port. Russia also seems to be revisiting Cold War concepts where they would develop an underwater nuclear device to create the conditions of a tsunami or, in other cases, to produce clouds of radiation. Now, just to give some background in some of what this talks about, there is some very concerning developments in undersea warfare, in submarines, like these unmanned submarine drones that it talks about. Russia is also working on some high-tech kind of composite materials to make their submarines much quieter. An expert in anti-submarine warfare, Tom Spahn, he said it only takes one submarine to change an entire geopolitical region. If you have the threat of even one submarine lurking off the coast undetected, a carrier strike group, and the carrier strike groups is an aircraft carrier plus all its escorts, and the entire US Navy is built around these carrier strike groups. It's pretty much broken up the bulk of the power into these groups. So if you have the threat of even one submarine lurking off the coast undetected, a carrier strike group is going to have to think twice about going to that area. For years, the US, they've pretty much been able to track just about everybody else's submarines. They've been able to track Russia's submarines with relative ease. You know, they've had listening posts and underwater sensors around areas where Russian submarines would have to leave to get to the ocean. And they've used that to kind of track them, to shadow them. But a lot of that kind of era where America could keep tabs on other people's submarines is coming to an end, and may have come to an end already. Drone subs, you know, they can be much smaller, much quieter, much harder to hear. And then these other newer submarines, they could radically change America's dominance in this area. And it can mean that America is now far more likely to be surprised by foreign submarines. Earlier in the year, the National Interest, they drew attention to the danger posed by new, more advanced submarines that are out there already. And they wrote that Washington's nuclear-powered attack and ballistic submarines, aircraft carriers and surface combatants, all guided by the best-trained sailors and professionals in the world, are no match when stacked up on paper one-on-one against the likes of Russia, China, Iran or any other challenger. But just a bit further down, they write, however, thanks to advances in modern, ultra-quiet, conventional diesel-electric submarines, Washington will need to adjust its tactics if it were to tangle with any nation sporting these increasingly sophisticated weapons of war. So there are new, modern, ultra-quiet submarines out there. They write, National Interest writes that newer boats are coming armed with advanced anti-ship weapons and are being combined with new air-independent propulsion systems, making them near impossible to find in the ocean's depths, a 1-2 punch that can't be ignored. Recent history shows only too clearly the challenge the United States and other modern navies are facing from these heavily armed stealth submarines. And the article goes on to talk about a test the US Navy did where they, it was about 10 years ago, and a whole series of tests in 2005. They did a mock battle with the HMS Gotland. This is one of these newer submarines that is in the Swedish Navy. And they did it with one of these from the Swedish Navy because America doesn't actually have any of these newer type of ultra-quiet diesel submarines. I don't know how they stack up in quietness compared to America's nuclear attack submarines, but as we'll see from what we're going to talk about, probably not so well. The Gotland class, the Gotland class submarine, it's a pretty impressive weapon. And so the US Navy wanted to find out how well they would do against these newer types of submarines, whether they could find them. And so back in 2005, they hosted the Gotland for 2 years, and they did a series of mock battles. And here's a report from NBC News from back then on how that went.
Frederick Linden is commander of the HMS Gotland. He and his crew of 29 called the sub base at Point Loma home. They came here to San Diego because the Navy is worried about this new generation of silent subs. The Pentagon leased the Gotland for 1 year, but has now extended that lease for a second year as they try to learn why this submarine is so difficult to find underwater. Subs have always had two weaknesses. They make noise and they can't stay submerged very long. But the Gotland runs on a high-tech system called Air Independent Propulsion, or AIP.
With AIP, I can stay submerged for weeks.
Not only can this submarine stay submerged for about a month, the AIP technology also makes it quieter than other submarines and almost impossible to pick up on sonar.
When the Gotland wants to be silent and undetectable, especially along coastal waters, there's no place it can't go. And that's one of the reasons it's here.
Since last summer, the Navy has spent months playing games of cat and mouse with the Gotland off San Diego. And time after time, the Swedish submarine has eluded its pursuers.
As an adversary, how good are you at what you do?
Very, very good.
According to Swedish newspapers, in training exercises, the Gotland has sunk our most sophisticated nuclear-powered submarines. But perhaps even more disconcerting, it reportedly sunk our largest aircraft carrier, the USS Reagan.
She's really run rings around our carrier battle groups.
Norman Pollmar is a military analyst who specializes in naval intelligence. He says that since the end of the Cold War, the funding of the Navy's anti-submarine warfare program has been scaled back dramatically. As the United States funnels billions of dollars into the war on terror, countries like North Korea, China, and Iran are building or trying to get submarines like the Gotland. 2 months ago in the Persian Gulf, Iran tested a new anti-ship missile fired by one of its submarines. If the Iranians are successful in getting a Gotland-class submarine, it could pose a new silent danger to the vital oil tanker traffic in the region.
With more of these submarines being bought by countries that don't particularly like us, Iran being a good example, yes, there is a threat.
And the commander of the Gotland knows just how vulnerable the United States could be if a sub like his fell into the wrong hands.
If I was to look at our coast in North America, was there any place you couldn't go?
No.
No place.
And there is more. The Swedes are currently working on another silent submarine that can also survive a direct hit by a torpedo. But the United States remains committed to our nuclear submarine force, and there are no plans to develop a submarine or purchase one like the Gotland. The Navy says it just wants to know how to detect and kill those subs.
Now, that should be pretty concerning. There are submarines out there capable of basically sinking an entire fleet, an entire carrier strike group, America's biggest ships, and being undetected. And going back to what we talked about right at the top of the program, you know, the U.S. has all of this money, but it's been focusing on fighting terrorists. Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, they don't have many submarines. And so America for years has backed off on this area of anti-submarine warfare. And now it's found that it's getting horribly behind. And this was 10 years ago. This type of technology that you heard about on that video, the air-independent propulsion, and the speculation that some of these other nations could be getting their hands on them. This technology is now far, far more common. And the National Interest piece from this year talks about how Russia is working on a new generation of even quieter submarines. It's not just Sweden or European powers that have this type of technology, but and even it would be concerning even if they have that technology and can hit America's ships undetected. So submarines have only gotten much quieter since that video was made. So the U.S. is already facing submarines that it can't detect. And that background makes those statements from Colucci in this U.S. News and World Report article that we've been focusing on since the start, that makes those statements even more concerning. These drones, drone submarines would be incredibly hard to detect with some of the stealth technology and then just being so much smaller because they don't have to cater for a human crew. And then it talked about how Russia was researching things like using nuclear devices to set off tsunamis. If Russia succeeded in that, would they be able to set off a tsunami, and no one knew where it came from. No one knew even that another foreign power was responsible for it. Now, going back to this Colucci article, the third thing that he talks about is the anti-satellite system that Russia and China and others are developing, or anti-satellite systems, how they're focusing on trying to take out America's satellites in space. I won't spend too long on this because I wrote an article on this subject for the Trumpet magazine that you can look up on our website if you like, and did a whole program on it last year. But it is a major problem. The U.S. military is incredibly dependent upon satellites that now they're realizing are actually very fragile. So much depends on the global positioning satellites, on spy satellites, communication satellites. And there would really be this major sense of blindness if these were shot down. And here's a short quote from a 60 Minutes interview from a year ago with U.S. Air Force General John Hyten, which we played when we covered this subject about 6 months ago.
I've read reports by a congressional commission which said that in the next 5 to 10 years, China likely will be able to hold at risk U.S. national security satellites in every orbital regime. Do you agree with this statement by the commission?
I think they'll be able to threaten every orbital regime that we operate in. Now, we have to figure out how to defend those satellites. And we're going to.
So this is another area of major weakness for the U.S. These systems that it's so dependent upon could be shot down by China, by Russia, by other more advanced powers. And then even now it's looking like nations like North Korea, like Iran, they could be developing capabilities to shoot down at least low-flying satellites. But here's what Colucci says is the most disturbing aspect of this story. And he's really spot on with this. He writes, "The question should never be focused on when these weapons will be deployed or how. The question is, why? Why the pursuit of weapons that will inherently threaten the United States from an existential perspective? The threats here are not about degrading America's influence in a region like the Middle East. The threat here is to topple America from a position of strategic primacy, which guarantees international stability. It will overturn the old concepts of mutually assured destruction and lead to inevitable thoughts of preemption and prevention. The side that wishes the arms race would not happen has already been left at the wayside of history." That's America today, left at the wayside of history. This defense expert writing in the U.S. News and World Report is saying that should be getting a whole lot of attention. But unfortunately, it's not. And he's right about so much of this. Why is Russia, why is China, why are other powers developing these weapons that are useful for just about one thing only? And that is crippling and bringing down the United States. As he points out, you know, drone submarines, they're not going to help Russia gain an advantage in Syria. They're not going to help improve Chinese influence in Africa. These are things about that would be useful for sinking the U.S. Pacific Fleet, for launching attacks on the U.S. mainland. They're major, major threats. And it says a lot about what these nations are thinking about for the future. And then he also makes a good point that what a lot of these technologies have in common, and I'll throw in cyber warfare here too, is that there's a huge advantage for the person who strikes first. If Russia can sink the American fleet with stealthy submarines, for example, and America can also sink the Russian fleet, but neither side can defend their fleet successfully, there's a huge incentive to make sure that you make the first move, that you strike them preemptively before they can strike you. And that applies across the board to a whole load of these new and emerging technologies that are being embraced by armed forces around the world. And Colucci, he talks about how the next U.S. president needs to heavily invest in new technologies and to ways to counter these threats. And he concludes, if America chooses to ignore this due to naivety, strategic foppery, or bean counting, we will be subject to those powers that are more fastidious and realistic in their approach. We will wake up one morning like the French knights at Agincourt, wondering how their ranks were decimated by the English longbow. That's a powerful warning from the US News and World Report, one that people need to be listening to. America's not being realistic about the world that it lives in when it comes to defense planning and military planning. But Russia is, China is, these other nations, Europe is getting more realistic. But America is not. Now, there's another powerful article on the US military published within the last few days that I'll just spend a few minutes quoting a bit from. This one was from Andrew J. Bracevich from the Boston Globe. And it's called War Out of Sight, Sacrifice Out of Mind. And he makes a powerful point about the changing way the US deals with and interacts with its military and conducts war. He begins by talking about during the Civil War and World War II, quote, a widely shared, if imperfect, collective culture imbued the war effort with effectiveness that contributed directly to victory. He writes that during the Civil War, quote, a widely shared, if imperfect, collective culture imbued the war effort with effectiveness that contributed directly to victory. From the very outset of the war that the United States has for decades waged in various parts of the Islamic world, just the reverse has been true. An absence of cultural solidarity has undermined military effectiveness. These days, American culture posits a minimal definition of citizenship. It emphasizes choice rather than duty and self-gratification over sacrifice. And he's right. Today, people think far more about what they can get from the country and the government than on any duty they may have to give. He continues, pay your taxes, obey the law, civic obligation extends that far and no further. So in conducting military campaigns in the Islamic world, presidents from Carter's day to our own have asked little, indeed next to nothing, from the vast majority of citizens. They are spectators rather than participants. And he goes on to talk about how few are willing to serve in the military, with some amazing statistics. He talks about how one third of Harvard's graduates from its senior class, for example, go to Wall Street. But then how many from Harvard were in the annual military commissioning ceremony? It was not a third. It was four. Just four people. And he continues, in truth, the pool of the willing is not deep. Sustaining what depth there is requires incentive. Since 9/11, new recruit pay has jumped by 50%. Reenlistment bonuses can run as high as $150,000. In a material culture, appeals to patriotism don't suffice to elicit and retain volunteers. Inducing people to put their lives on the line requires upfront compensation. Even then, the few remain few. And he's right, and that says a lot about our culture. And he goes on to talk about how this affects the economy as well. Because we're not willing to shoulder any extra burden of war, and the government tries to kind of shield the nation and the people from even the ideas of war, and the fact that the war is becoming so expensive, that wars aren't really working, that America is spending more and more money but having less and less success, at least when it comes to war. You know, the defense budget is falling, but America spent a lot of money in Iraq, a lot of money in Afghanistan for just about nothing in return. But anyway, with all that money, extra money needed for those invasions, it doesn't come from extra taxes, it's borrowed. Ours is not a pay-as-you-go culture, this article continues. It's go now and worry about the bills later. He talks about how since 9/11, the national debt, America's national debt, has increased fourfold. Now, that's not all due to war, but they have been very expensive. And he writes, by and large, Americans are okay with slouching off onto future generations the responsibility of paying for wars presumably undertaken on their own behalf. A bit like buying a pricey car and sticking your grandkids with the payments. And I thought there were some good points about the military consequences and the military weakness that results from the weakness in modern culture. Now, we'll take a short break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about another way America is weakening itself, and this time by building up a major rival. So I'll talk to you again after the break.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
So I've come here today to the heart of Europe to say that the United States and the entire world needs a strong and prosperous and democratic and united Europe.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting for Mr. Stephen Flurry. You're listening on KPCG, either on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, or on kpcg.fm. If you miss any part of this program or want to listen to any more, you can go to, or any of our other programs, you can go to kpcg.fm and listen to many of our programs online anytime you like. I just, before the break, we're talking about some excellent articles on the state of America's military. But as you heard, we're shifting gears a little bit with that clip that we played right at the start of this segment. As I'm sure you're all very aware, US President Barack Obama traveled to Europe this week, and we heard a brief clip from his speech in Hanover, where he was more pro-European than many Europeans themselves are right now. He called for unity, European unity in economics, in defense. Here's another clip from that speech.
And today, more than ever, a strong, united Europe remains, as Adenauer said, a necessity for all of us. It's a necessity for the United States because Europe's security and prosperity is inherently indivisible from our own. We can't cut ourselves off from you. Our economies are integrated, our cultures are integrated, our peoples are integrated. You saw the response of the American people to Paris and Brussels. It's because, in our imaginations, this is our cities. A strong, united Europe is a necessity for the world because an integrated Europe remains vital to our international order. Europe helps to uphold the norms and rules that can maintain peace and promote prosperity around the world.
So this is a very pro-European president. One of the journalists that I follow on Twitter, after all the big firestorm of in Britain about his comments about Britain going to the back of the queue if it leaves the EU, he tweeted a couple of lines from America's speech on Europe, and he kind of remarked almost with surprise, he's not just saying these things, he actually believes in Europe. And there is a very strong sense from these speeches that he really does embrace the European ideal, and that's why he wants Britain to remain in Europe. But what I want to talk about on in this segment now is that in doing this, Mr. Obama, he is continuing American policy that goes all the way back to the immediate aftermath of World War II. America has done a huge amount, not just to build up the individual European nations, but to encourage the European Union itself and to try and push Europe to build a European superstate. We've talked a bit on this program about how a united Europe can and will be a powerful force, independent of the United States and even a rival of the United States. And the United States, they've done a huge amount to build that potential rival. Here's what George Friedman wrote at a recent article on geopolitical futures. The article was called Obama and the European Union. And he wrote, to begin at the beginning, European integration was an American idea. When Paul Henry Spark and Robert Schuman may have thought of the idea, it was the Marshall Plan that first had increased European integration as one of its goals. The Americans believed that their mission was to revive Europe and that the infusion of money wasn't enough. Creating a harmonized economic structure was central to the recovery, so the United States pressed for some form of integration. He continued to talk about how Charles de Gaulle embraced the idea of a European Union, believing that a united Europe could be a powerful vehicle for French interests and allow them to have some independence from the United States. So that's why the French came round to embracing it. But right at the start, there was a lot, and even throughout the project, a lot of encouragement to do this from America. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard over at The Telegraph, he had a similar piece published today, or Thursday, so yesterday when this goes out. And he writes, it was Washington that drove European integration in the late 40s and funded it covertly under the Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson and Nixon administrations. And then he writes about how the Schuman Declaration that set the tone for Franco-German reconciliation and would lead by stages to the European community was cooked up by the U.S. Secretary of State Dean Acheson. And then he quotes Robert Schuman's chief of staff saying it all began in Washington. And he talks about how back in the early days of the European Union, all the way back in 1950, the U.S. really forced the program along, threatening to cut off aid from the Marshall Fund if France didn't comply with this European idea of European Union, the European Union. A lot of these founding fathers of Europe, they worked with the United States. They received support from the United States. You know, they still ideologically believed in Europe and in a European Union, but they were supported by the U.S. too. And Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, he goes on to write, nor are many aware of declassified documents from the State Department archives showing that U.S. intelligence funded the European movement secretly for decades and worked aggressively behind the scenes to push Britain into the project. And then he continues, as this newspaper first reported when the treasure became available, one memorandum dated July 26, 1950, reveals a campaign to promote a full-fledged European Parliament. It is signed by General William J. Donovan, head of the American Wartime Office of Strategic Services, precursor of the Central Intelligence Agency. And then a bit further down, he writes, a memo dated June 11th, 1965, instructs the Vice President of the European Community to pursue monetary union by stealth, suppressing debate until the adoptions of such proposals would become virtually inescapable. So America was pushing Europe towards monetary union. That's the creation of the euro. America wanted Europe to share a common currency, as they knew that it would force European nations closer together towards becoming this superstate. And European elites wanted the same thing, and so eventually it happened, and that paved the way for the euro crisis that we see right now, which is forcing Europe to unite and at least some nations to come together, even though many people in the democracies themselves don't want that. And a lot of this encouragement of Europe was done by the American Committee on United Europe, or the ACUE. The CIA was one of the main bodies involved in encountering the Soviet Union within Europe. And so a lot of the funds for this effort and for the ACUE, they came from the CIA. The Roosevelt Study Center, they produced a book called The Cultural Cold War in Western Europe, 1945 to 1960. talks about this, and they wrote about how the ACUE supported a, quote, domestic propaganda campaign designed to persuade American public opinion of the need for a more united Europe. The main duty of this ACUE, this American Committee on a United Europe, though, was to, quote, arrange discreet American financial assistance for the European supporters of such federalist initiatives as the Council of Europe, the Schuman Plan, and the European Army. He goes on to this report, this art book, goes on to write about how by the mid-1950s, the CIA was, quote, funding the ACUE to the tune of about $1 million per year, making it one of the US's most expensive covert operations in the early Cold War period. Now, I want to make clear the EU is not solely some CIA plot. There were plenty of passionate people in Europe who wanted the European Union. The Catholic Church was a really strong supporter and did a lot in the early days to help get it going. But the US helped support it and helped nurture the idea in the early days of post-war Europe, where many in Europe were simply focused on just rebuilding their nations after the war. And this isn't, you know, whenever you start talking about the CIA getting involved in things, it sounds a bit like it's time to put on your tinfoil hats. But this isn't a conspiracy theory either. This history isn't talked about much, but it is well accepted. We've been quoting from The Telegraph, from George Friedman, from the Roosevelt Study Center, which is a mainstream academic research institute in the Netherlands. The EU Observer has written on it. So it's mainstream accepted fact. The US, they wanted Britain, and they wanted Britain in the EU. There was diplomatic pressure to change, to get Britain to join the EU. There were this efforts to change the minds of Britons about the EU. There were, for a long time, rumours that the CIA backed Britain staying in the EU when the UK first held a referendum on the subject back in 1975. And since then, that has been confirmed. Dr. Richard J. Aldrich, he's from Nottingham University. He got a hold of a bunch of papers, government papers and things. He wrote a research paper about the influence that the CIA in Britain had and how that they worked to get Britain to vote to stay in the EU all the way back in 1975. So there was a lot of effort and a lot of investment from America into persuading Britain to join the EU, in the creation of the EU, encouraging Europe to become more united, to encourage Europe to move towards becoming a super state, to encourage Europe to develop military even. Why? America feared Russia. They believed that a prosperous and a united Europe would be better able to face and oppose Russia. And in 1980, Herbert W. Armstrong, he wrote about the support that this union had in the United States, writing, "This coming United States of Europe is the dream of many leaders, not only within Europe, but in Britain and America. The common market is only its beginning." So he saw the support that it had within people, even in America, that were trying to bring this about. And here's a quote from Mr. Armstrong that we've played on this program before that talks about the difficulty America has in seeing its enemies and in seeing enemies in general.
"Now, prophecy gives a general broad outline of the events that are taking place on the earth now and those that are going to happen. It does specifically tell us of one of the phases of World War that we believe is now the next one that we will call World War III. And it is not coming from the power and the source that we seem to suspect. No, we in the United States, my friends, seem to be so stupid we never can tell where our real enemy is until after he strikes. We can only see one enemy at a time, and I want to tell you that the United States has more than one enemy. Now, we fought a war against Germany, World War II, and Japan. Of course, we said at the beginning of World War II that we would certainly do away with German militarism and it would never rise up its ugly head again. We were going to demolish it once and for all, and after we got it demolished, now we start to rise it up ourselves because we think we have to have it as a buffer and a protection against Russia. And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
This gets to the heart of the problem that we saw in the first half of this program as well. You know, America could only see one enemy at a time back then. And back then, or one enemy at a time. And back then, that enemy was radical Islam. And so America stopped focusing on submarines. They stopped focusing against defending from hypersonic missiles. It just looked at Al-Qaeda. And now America is becoming a little concerned about Russia and China, but they don't see any potential danger from Europe. And so, just as Mr. Armstrong talked about, they're encouraging Europe to rise, as we heard those quotes from Mr. Obama at Hanover at the start of the program. And that's exactly what the Bible prophesied, that America would abandon Britain, as Mr. Flurry talked about on this program on Monday, that America would trust in foreign allies for protection. And here's how Mr. Armstrong described those Bible prophecies.
This is for us today, my friends. This is a prophecy. This is not some old, dead and gone ancient history. This is a live, living prophecy. An energized prophecy under the inspiration of God Almighty, and it's for us, and this is the message of God. This is the Thus Saith the Eternal. All your allies have forgotten you. They care nothing for you, for I have dealt you the blow of an enemy. Our allies. All right. Your lovers, your allies, Germany and Japan, don't care anything for you, and they're going to forget us too. And God says, I have dealt you the blow of an enemy. The punishment, which is going to happen now in less than 25 years, the punishment of a merciless foe, because your guilt is great, because your sins are so flagrant.
Mr. Armstrong was a bit out on the timing, but that was he was quoting Jeremiah 30, verse 14. And we see this, though, absolutely true today. America has done so much to build up its enemies. And it's put so much trust in these nations that it thinks are allies. And as the prophecy that Mr. Armstrong brought out, those allies are going to turn against America. And we see, as I said, so America is building up its allies with its enemies. With the Iran deal, they're building up Iran. And then they helped encourage Europe to unite. They helped Europe break up Yugoslavia. They're continuing to encourage Europe to build up its military in Iran, in Europe. America is sowing the seeds of its own destruction. I'm rapidly running out of time, but I want to conclude on a more positive note. I've quoted a few articles that I thought were good this week, but I've saved my absolute favourite for last, and you'll see why pretty soon. It's called Setting the Record Straight on Britain, America, and World War II by Victor Davis Hanson. And you know, Victor Davis Hanson, he's a very well-respected historian, as well as being quite a prolific commentator. He really knows what he's talking about, and he begins this article. While in London last week, President Obama waded into the upcoming British referendum about whether the United Kingdom should stay in the European Union. Controversy followed his lecture about the future of the Anglo-American relationship should Britain depart the EU. Mr. Obama also implied that without an EU, the United States might again be dragged into European squabbling as it had been in the prior world wars. Americans might take this occasion to reflect on Britain's role in World War II. And that's exactly what he does in this article. And he writes, Great Britain was the only major power to fight for the entire duration of World War II, from its beginning after the invasion of Poland on September 1, 1939, until the surrender of the Japanese in Tokyo Bay on September 2, 1945. And then he also writes, In the late June of 1940, after the fall of Western Europe, Britain was the only major power in the world still resisting Nazi Germany. Otherwise, all of Europe was either occupied by Hitler, neutral, or supposedly neutral, but surreptitiously aiding the Third Reich with shipments of supplies. And that was the period, at least very famous in Britain's history over here, where Britain stood alone. That was the spirit of independence, of defiance to Germany that was stirred up by Churchill during that time. There was no one else, at least no other other major power standing with Britain. And of course, talking about this on a radio program, I can't resist the opportunity to play the clip from Churchill's speech at that time that really rallied the nation to this, to stand up to Germany and to do so alone. So we'll just play that clip quickly now.
Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
There was a lot of expectation that Britain would make peace with Hitler at this point. But Britain didn't. Another, if someone else had been Prime Minister, not Churchill, Lord Halifax, for example, they may have done that. But Churchill chose to fight on, and that was possibly the most important decision of the 20th century. I recently read Andrew Roberts' History of World War II called The Storm of War. And if you want a readable, comprehensive, yet not too long history of the war, I strongly recommend that book. And one case that he makes very strongly is that Hitler could have won that war. Had he made a few decisions differently, he could have beaten Russia, or he could have held Europe. Today, we kind of take it for granted that Hitler was crazy, that no one country or relatively small alliance could take on all the world. But take a detailed look at that history, and a different picture emerges. Had Churchill not led Britain to stand alone, had he allowed Hitler time to really consolidate his gains, then all Europe may have been lost, and eventually Hitler would have this massive base within Europe that he could continue to push outwards from. Now, going back to this Victor David Hansen article, he writes, Britain, along with soon-to-be-defeated France, was also the rare major combatant that entered the war on the principle of aiding a weaker ally. And he continues, in terms of population and territory, Great Britain was the smallest of what became known as the Grand Alliance of Britain, America, and Russia. Yet its military research and leadership proved essential for the Allied victory. Britain mobilized its industry in astonishing fashion, similar to the US wartime economic miracle. The British Empire built more warships, military and transport aircraft, and vehicles and artillery pieces than did Hitler's Third Reich. Landmark British advances in radar, sonar, cryptology, aeronautics, and nuclear physics empowered the Allied war effort. And he talked about some of the things like the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine that turned the American P-51 Mustang into a bit of a dud, into a superb fighter plane. And he talks about how some of the war's most astute war planners and strategists were British. How Winston Churchill was the first Western statesman to warn about Hitler, the first to predict the Cold War that would follow Allied victory. And he writes, Britain helped America in World War II as much as America did Britain. We should keep that contribution in mind in speaking softly and preserving our long and mutually advantage partnership. He's right, there was a superb partnership there. Andrew Roberts, in the conclusion of his book, he writes that the strength of the three main allied nations were very different, but they each contributed something vitally necessary for overall victory. Without all three in the mix, that victory might not have arrived until much later in the 1940s, if at all. Elsewhere, he quotes Stalin, who said, "Great Britain provided time, the United States provided money, the Soviet Russia provided blood." And that's not a bad summary. But among those three allies, there was a special, close relationship between Britain and America. And Roberts, in that book, he notes the almost unprecedentedly close relationship between those forces. There were still rivalries, there were still jealousies, but in general, it was a great relationship. And in that war, Britain and America, they accomplished some amazing things together. We see that relationship now completely falling apart. And as Hansen points out, that is a bad thing for the world. But, in peace, in the peace that's coming, in the soon coming, wonderful world tomorrow, after the World War III that we heard Mr. Armstrong talk about in that clip, our two countries, Britain and America, they will again have a special relationship. And again, just like in World War II, accomplish great things, but this time in matters of peace, not simply in just stopping a war or in winning a war. You've been listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's about all that we've got time for. Tune in again on Monday here on KPCG. And that's on the website, on the internet at kpcg.fm. Or if you're in the Edmond, Oklahoma area, on 101.3 FM. Thanks for listening and tune in again next time.